Hello and welcome to Royale Without Cheese, our bi-weekly podcast in which we discuss both the classic and the unknown of art and popular cinema from the then and now. We are your hosts, me, Tomás Ferreira, Leonardo Miranda.
Hello.
And Miguel Aido.
Hi there.
This is our talk show segment where we welcome grand indie filmmakers to our wonderful couch and discuss their work. Here with us we have Beru Tessema, an Ethiopian-British film writer, director and playwright based in London, a graduate from London Film School and RADA, being currently an acting teacher at the latter. Beru's short film Lions was recently awarded the Unifrance Grand Prix for Best International Short Film at Cannes, competed at the Clermont-Ferrand International Film Festival, and was just nominated at BIFA for Best Short of 2023. Beyond his writing for short film theatre and TV, he co-wrote the 2017 feature film Barley Fields on the Other Side of the Mountain, nominated for Best Feature at the Valladolid International Film Festival. Today we'll be discussing Lions, along with other of his projects. And so, Beru, how are we feeling today?
Good, thanks. It's great to be here, and thank you for the wonderful introduction.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Well, we have to really start by saying that we've watched Lions, and your short film, we really felt it was deeply layered and humanistic in the way that it portrayed this struggle of this immigrant Congolese family in today's post-Brexit Britain. Mm-hmm. And it really, for our listeners, the story follows this family, and specifically Rosie, a teen who gets into this misunderstanding with these two window cleaners who threaten her home. And so we say layered because, first and foremost, you are capable of, in just about 23 minutes, and it's amazing how you do this, you're able to really explore in a very minute way several elements of the narrative in what I find the most interesting about cinema, which is picking up the different elements of what composes the social environment in which a character lives. And so you have the language barrier, which Rosie lives through very, very much. She has that, what's going to become fatal to her, which is that difficulty with the language, which is English. And then, of course, the financial struggle that the family has in keeping their home, a home which is everything to them, all the while is falling apart in poor living conditions. And also, humanistically, you have the fact that how Rosie really ends up solving, so to speak, the quarrel with the window cleaners in the sense that she shares her Congolese food, which is a very communal gesture. But interestingly enough, while we do see the racism in this antagonist, the window cleaners, in the sense, you also suggest their own struggles, which is in keeping with the very compassionate spirit and the complexity of the film. And so in essence, I found that what was one of the most interesting features was how the film really builds difficulty upon difficulty for this family in unexpected and gripping ways. And I was just gripped at my seat watching the film in empathy for the characters. And so we really want to ask, first and foremost, how was the writing process in finding these characters and finding the narrative structure?
Thank you for your response. You know, the writing process of this film, it took, I mean, you know, like financing the film and getting, you know, getting to the point where we could actually make it took some time. But during that time, you know, over a couple of years, kind of revisiting the story and thinking about it, particularly, you know, I mean, you know, Brexit was a long time ago now, but somehow, because it's such a kind of shocking thing, it still feels recent. Do you know what I mean? Because it's such an extreme thing. It's still kind of, it's very much in the air. So the thinking, my thinking was around how do we think and how do we experience, you know, this amazing city, London, which is, you know, the reason why it's so amazing for me anyway is because it's so international, so multicultural, and it's this incredible space where so many people from all over the world feel at home. But, you know, while that's happening, there's this kind of lingering feeling of, like, you know, Brexit and kind of this kind of nativist protectionist kind of sentiment somewhere in the air. Do you know what I mean? And so that was very much the core of what my inspiration was, which is we are all suffering on some level, and we're all trying to define our a space in which we belong, and I think that's important, actually, for me to, you know, when I came to the realization, actually, one can't demonize people who are, you know, Brexit voters, for example, because everyone has a reason, everyone has a justification, and that justification is often rooted in some kind of suffering, you know, some kind of, like, this, you know, disenfranchisement, you know. And I was really interested in trying to humanize this kind of tension that exists, you know, and of course it's something that's increasingly evident in so many parts of the world, not just in Europe, but, you know, the world has suddenly shifted into this space of being protectionist and being nativist. And at the core of it is, the reason why is because there's a bigger antagonist, there's a real antagonist, and the antagonist is a political and financial kind of system that often pits poor people, working class people, immigrants against each other, and kind of gets away with doing unbelievable damage. And people on the ground are just distracted by blaming each other and thinking the other person's a problem, when actually it's the structure we're forced to exist in that's the antagonist, you know. So it's just, I wanted to kind of find a very human and very simple way of trying to kind of capture a story, this kind of experience, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And like you say, you know, it's a phenomenon, Brexit, that really has roots up until today, and it changes the structure of how people live. For example, there was very recently, it came up on the news that a Portuguese man, a plumber, living in the UK for 20 years now, just because he missed his settlement scheme, like renewal, by one day, he was, I think, you know, he got into trial basically with the government, he'd get a lawyer just to justify himself because he was going to renew it. But it was the matter was just missing one day, which becomes crazy. Like it's a big transgression. Yeah. But yeah, and also kind of the question was also to do with how did you arrive at this specific narrative structure? Because it's amazing how you can, in the first 10 minutes, essentially, really worry yourself with allowing your character to have this setup where you can paint what is this world is living and breathing home for them, that they're struggling financially to keep it. Also, you have the detail of the windows that I find very interesting, that keeps coming back and how they need repairing. And how, for example, you know, you also, in that very little time, short amount of time, you do introduce the difficulty Rosie has with the language. And then later on, at 10 minutes, kind of, point mark, you have the inciting incident, so to speak, of the short film, which is kind of an amazing array of little details. And also something I find very interesting in those first 10 minutes, actually, is how you go further into another kind of narrative, and you have this immigrant family coming to contact. In this beautiful shot, you have Rosie and her mother, I think, I'm not sure.
Yes, yeah? Older sister, yes.
Older sister, okay, yes. I wasn't sure if that was the reality of the situation or not. They enter this house, this huge black house, kind of unseeable from the outside.
Yes.
And they go down this kind of patio hallway, and then you have this bent turn, and you see the family. And I think I sense there was something of your directing approach, playing with this preconception of the audience that the family needs to be rich and white, but actually it's a wealthy immigrant family.
That was very interesting.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, firstly, you know, to answer the first part of the question in terms of like how I arrived at that kind of narrative structure, I myself am an immigrant. I'm an immigrant from Ethiopia, and like, you know, I came to London when I was 8 years old. And so like I was thinking about what it's like when you come to a country in which, when I came to London, I didn't speak English. And so, I don't speak English. My mom didn't speak English. My mom did speak English, but, you know, it's a different kind of, you know, the kind of the subtleties of the way people communicate can be, you know, lost in translation and lost in kind of interaction, especially when you're new to a space. So I was thinking a lot about, you know, my relationship to Britishness or London is that of an immigrant. And so, a way of kind of dramatizing it is finding this kind of space in which, you know, like Rosie goes into, this family lives in, and this space is like, represents their dream. But something that's also really important in the story is, you know, the immigrant's idea of the young immigrants, you know, the child immigrant's idea of what London will be like. The Rosie's older sister, her sister's husband, like they're older, they know the realities. Whereas for Rosie, what she hears is that, oh, you know, the kind of how incredible life could be, you know. And so to have that expectation and to come into the reality and the gap between reality, you know, reality and kind of expectation is something that I was really interested in exploring. And also the language is key, because, you know, it's really where the conflict kind of comes from, the misunderstanding, the crossed wires, you know. At the same time, one of the things what was really important for me to make the family Congolese, because that's a Francophone African country in which, you know, Rosie already is already bilingual. She already speaks Lingala and French. And so, you know, there's a kind of racist slur that one experiences when new to a space and new to a language, which is learn English. You know, learn how to speak the language, whereas actually people already so making them Francophone, making them Congolese, making them bilingual. And she's also learning a third language, which is English. And I was also, it was really also important for me to make them Congolese, because it's a kind of almost forgotten country that's fueling our technological advances. Do you know what I mean? The minerals in the Congo, like the only place where they, you know, we can find certain minerals on the planet is in the Congo, and the people are suffering from like manufactured wars, you know, these kind of the, you know, it's dire. The situation there is really dire, and yet the world is unaware. So the reason why I say that is because the reality is the comfort we exist in as Westerners, you know, and the technical advances we have in the West is at the expense of countries like the Congo. Do you know what I mean? So when countries like that are destabilized, and then you have people who come to, you know, these countries for a better life, they're seen as like invaders, when actually they are refugees because we, you know, the West has had some kind of impact on their lives, and so they've been made to become refugees. Do you know what I mean? So these are the things I was thinking about in terms of like the construction of the story world, the family, where they come from, you know, but not thinking too politically about it. But it was just really important, and you know, people might see it and not think about the Congo, but just to kind of send that kind of possibility of people discovering and being curious about what's going on in the Congo and why those things are going on. And I think beyond that, it's this thing of like the immigrant's dream and the immigrant's reality, which is represented in that flat.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yeah, it's very sensitive of you to choose that as the origins of the character. And I do believe that often when you watch a film, you often get, you know, provoked to go research further. And that's part of the magic of cinema. You know, you get really provoked by a film to search for answers even beyond the narrative. Lastly, in terms of writing, we really want to ask, what are, in a sense, the methods, the rituals that you have, that you set for yourself when writing? There's always that kind of discussion, what does a writer do? Everybody has a different process, method, the way of inputting a discipline in your day-to-day, in the sense of, okay, I'm going to arrive at this scene today or at that scene tomorrow, and this is going to turn into a sequence. What are more or less those rituals or habits for you?
You know what, like recently I've discovered so much of writing is in rewriting. Do you know what I mean? Some, you know, so much of, like, you know, from my experience, when I arrive at a draft that makes sense, it feels like the story's been unlocked, and it feels like, you know, the story already existed. And so the writing process is like the process of excavation, a process of excavation. And so for me, it's like writing is quite, you know, it's the routine of, like, you know, repetition, I think, you know, and the fact that, you know, 90% of it is just like repetition and routine, and, you know, getting to the desk and, you know, really kind of working through it, and like 10% is like inspiration. Do you know what I mean? Which is like, it's incredible when the inspiration is there, but particularly with screenwriting, because it's so technical and it's so visual, one has to be like very, I just think, you know, there's a certain discipline, and the discipline is to do with being able to constantly go back to the scene and to the script and kind of try to see it with new eyes each time. But for me, like the redrafting process is like the key. The redrafting process, and also like the plotting. Plotting is the key when it comes to like screenwriting. And you know, once you've, but revisiting and questioning, but something else that's really important to me is when I get to a certain point with the script, I get the actors that I'm working with to come on board and really investigate the relationships that's on the page, and the things that the characters say that's on the page with the actors. Because something that's really important for me in my process is giving space during the shoot for the actors to improvise, you know, because when they improvise, like, you know, in this film, for example, just some really extraordinary things came out, like some really astonishing moments. You know, for example, the guy who plays the younger window cleaner, I think he's an amazing actor, Morgan Watkins. We worked together, and, you know, and part of the preparation was really thinking about, you know, in a really empathic way, really, you know, humanizing this character that ultimately becomes an antagonist. But in humanizing it, we really created a kind of backstory, you know, that the actor really came up with as he was developing the character. And there's a moment where he comes into the, you know, when the conflict happens, the way he describes the flats, the way he describes, you know, how this was a place where he knew so-and-so lived in that flat, so-and-so lived in that flat, and now this is, you know, it's full of them, their meaning immigrants, you know. And that moment just feels so like kind of potent. It feels so potent because it was a moment that happened from a real connection that the actor has, an empathic connection that has the character. So I think beyond just writing, there's something about collaborating with actors that I just think yields something that a writer can't necessarily see.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We had a director previously on our podcast who, in talking to him afterward, he said precisely what you're saying in regards to when writing the script. I often give it to the actors afterwards because they can comment on what works on the dialogue and what doesn't. And it's interesting that you mentioned Morgan, because I sense that you two came from the same place, I think Northwest.
Yes, London. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
So
yeah, he's a good friend of mine. Yeah.
Cool. He's amazing. I think, you know, there's so much detail in that scene. Just him banging the glass really felt like a natural thing. And surprising. I could see that as part of his improvisation in the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. That scene, for example, when he bangs the window, but then when he's outside, and you know, Rosie has closed the door, and then she closes the window, and there's the moment where he's stood outside the window, you know, with the letter. That was just, I mean, I just thought that was such a powerful moment that we just discovered. There was something about the way he engaged with the space and how instinctive he was and how free he was, that I think just really elevated the film, actually.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Yeah, and speaking of actors, in your film, you do take the point of view of the children. You know, they have this, because according to what you said, they have this openness, really. They haven't been exposed to the roughness of the real world, its bureaucracy, its rules. Did you direct the child actors differently from the adult actors in this film?
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting. I feel like, you know, as someone who works as an acting teacher, one of the things, you know, we often discover is, part of the training of an actor is returning to a childlike state, you know. So with kids, I find one doesn't necessarily need to direct them, because it's a very kind of, it's more about encouraging their imagination, and making them aware of the kind of dynamics, you know. But there's something about, like, when a child is directed, that they can become performative, and that doesn't work necessarily on, you know, in a naturalistic film. So we were very lucky in finding Cornelio, who played Jojo, because the amazing casting director, Harry Gilbert, we just did lots of workshops with lots of different kids, and we were looking for someone who wasn't, you know, a kind of, you hadn't gone to like drama school or stage school or anything like that, just someone who's very kind of authentic and just kind of very natural, and in observing them in a kind of workshop environment, what we were looking for was a child that was observant, a child that was kind of that had his kind of attention in a way that was quite externalized, and watchful and kind of responsive. And so Canino was very kind of just natural. We didn't really need to do much with him. But I mean, there is, of course, an element of directing, and that is to do with being playful. When it's like a game, when they're allowed to play and it becomes playful. Like, I love the opening sequence. And in the opening sequence, it's like, you know, Canino was just like, you know, joyfully playing like a kid would play. And the my job was to make him feel comfortable with the crew and the camera. With the crew and the camera, but like once he was comfortable with that, then it's, you know, doing what he does all the time as a child, which is playing and imagining and inhabiting that imagination.
Yeah, definitely. I find it, you know, it's one of the beauties of the film, how you can contrast the hardships of living in that house, but at the same time, the kids finding a sense of normalcy and happiness. I direct a short film where likewise I had to direct a child actress, and likewise my film opens with a sense of play between mother and daughter in this case, and they are masked. It's Halloween and the mother is like in a cat suit, so it's very similar in that sense. And yeah, it's, I agree with you in the sense that you need to find a sense of playfulness with the actors. We did a lot of theater games in my case, so, and that really helped the trust between them. It was very easy on the day. And then finally, on the sense of actors, directing actors, you being one yourself who studied at RADA, become a lecturer there, and even a working actor who's been at Shakespeare Globe Theatre and film and TV dramas, we were really interested in understanding, how do you prepare your directing notes as an actor director virtually? You know, how do you see yourself different from other directors who don't have that experience in front of the camera?
You know, this, like in terms of like giving notes, like I very much like to be, you know, as kind of close to the actors, or, you know, or like as close to the camera as possible. So for me, like when they're playing the scene, I like to feel like I'm involved in the scene. Do you know what I mean? Where I don't like being too far away, like on the monitor, like, because there's something about that distance that I kind of feel, for me anyway, just, you know, it stops me from being involved, emotionally involved in the rhythms and the beats of the scene. But there's something about kind of embodying, there's something about watching the actors embodying the scene, and as a director also embodying the scene. Do you know what I mean? Living through the scene. And so when it comes to giving notes, for me, I think having been, you know, been an actor as well, you know, there's something about when directors give notes and it's too kind of like overly intellectualized, or when it's kind of very, you know, kind of abstract, and you know, that kind of send me into my head, and I'll start, you know, just think, what does the director mean? But actually, there's something about the very simple notes. So I think, so the challenge is like, as when I have notes, it's like boil it down to something that's kind of immediate and simple, in which I'm not talking at the actor, but actually kind of allowing or giving space to the actor to discover the notes themselves by giving like simple prompts, that, because part of it is about kind of making the actors feel confident. Do you know what I mean? And I think so, like, and as an actor, you know, you're always trying to please people and please the director, but actually it should be about the actor being free and confident, and feeling and knowing that the actor is collaborating with the director. And so there's no kind of like power dynamic, but it's more kind of like we're collaborating. So simplifying the notes, actually making it quite conversational and letting the actors lead, I find, because the thing is, when you have a take that works, you feel it and they feel it. Do you know what I mean? But I feel like there's something about the way in which a note is communicated that can push a direct an actor away from the imagined reality of the scene and living in the scene, basically, and they start being too much in their head. And I think that's the thing I try to avoid.
Exactly. Not indicate a feeling, but yet, but instead being in the feeling.
Exactly.
Do you find yourself often giving, in the sense of what the notes specifically are, using comparisons, action verbs, or even asking questions? What do you think this will lead? You know, what do you think?
Yeah.
You know,
I think, yeah, asking questions. I think asking questions, but you know, I think like rooting it as much as possible in like the relationships and the dynamics. Do you know what I mean? Like rooting it as much as possible, you know, in the story, because the more, like, even with the notes, the more it's kind of taking the actors really to like the actual story, like what they want. Like, I think wants and objectives, I think, are key things for me in terms of like that thing of like the want, the objective, the need, the desire, because that's like the motor, that's the engine. And I think when an actor is really connected to that, the scene really falls into place. Yeah, so it's question. I think questions are great. I think questioning, you know, asking the questions and you know, thinking about objectives, thinking about actions. I think that they're the key things I work with, and also the backstory, because you know, like I don't like rehearsing when it comes to you know, making a film. Because I think there's something kind of dangerous about finding something in the room, and then if it's brilliant, we try to find it again on set. But actually, like, the thing that's really valuable is the conversation you have and the kind of like excavation of the story, excavation of like the relationships that you have in the time that's rehearsal. So when we're on set, we can refer back to, you know, the backstory, the relationship, that really keeps them in the kind of world of the story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Would you say that, if I understand correctly, would you say that you do technical rehearsals and rehearsal with the actors before the shoot, and on the shoot you just let that process, you refer back to that, but it's freer. Let's find what else, what alternatives, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, because, you know, it's like, you know, when it's like when it's a complicated camera movement, rehearsals, I think, you know, of course, are
of
key.
Of course.
But when it comes to
handheld, you know, like in your film,
yes, exactly. You know, when it's for example, when it seems, I just think there's something about, you know, discussing the scenes in, you know, when we have like prep time, rehearsal time, we're discussing the scenes and we're discussing the relationship in the scenes, the objectives in the scenes, and if the actors are like really at depth, really kind of connecting to why the characters are doing what they're doing, like, that is the best kind of rehearsal. Because when they're connected to that at depth, they have a confidence in the choices that they're going to make. So when they're on set, it becomes actually the prep work is done, exact second nature. Whereas, you know, the danger with rehearsals is like, if we rehearse the scene and, okay, I'm going to say this line like this, and okay, something about that worked, when I'm on set, I'm going to repeat that, it becomes a repetition as opposed to something that's really happening in the moment.
So yeah, a distinctive aspect of this short is the very solid acting of the performers, which, yeah, can take us to the directing side of the rehearsals and the shoot, as we've discussed, but also further to the casting itself. So what methods have you found in your experience most helpful when casting actors? What do you ask of them? And what has worked best or worst when making the casting decision, if you look, you know, retrospectively at the actors' performances?
You know what, like, apart from Rosie, who, like, we, you know, we looked everywhere, and then eventually, we found Melody, who plays Rosie, and, you know, she sent us a tape. On the tape, it was, like, immediate. You could absolutely see this is an actor that has just is so alive on screen and is so instinctive and is so convincing. So there's something about, like, you know, those rare moments where you look at a tape and you know immediately this is exactly the person for the role. With everyone else, what we did was we did like a kind of workshop, you know, because something I think, you know, having been an actor, there's something very kind of awful about auditions. you know, it's awful.
I think everyone agrees with that.
Yeah, because, you know, there's something about, you know, people are sitting behind a desk or something, and then a person comes into the room and they somehow have to convince the people behind the desk that they should get the job. And there's like, it doesn't work for me. Some actors are really good at auditions. Some really brilliant actors are terrible at auditions. Do you know what I mean? So the process that was really important in the casting is finding a kind of a sense of relaxation, a sense of like playfulness, a sense of like exploration, which of course is a luxury, you know, to have like time to do that, to have time and space to do that. But I kind of think that's literally the best method for me, which is it becomes conversational. You get a sense of what the actor's point of view is on the story, on the characters, etc., and how much empathy that the characters have towards their characters, how instinctively they understand the characters, and not just the conversation, but then we get to explore the scene. Do you know what I mean? We get to explore the scene, like take it on its feet, move around in the space with it. And I mean, for example, when we did that, the actor who plays the older window cleaner, amazing actor Todd McCarty, what he did in that workshop was astonishing. You know, it was like it was incredible, like the level of connection he found and the instinctive relationship him and Morgan had in the space. You know, you just see it, and you know, you explore it. So like, yeah, with auditions, I think it's more conversational, more playful, and kind of taking the strange kind of power dynamic away. And so people become free to kind of like, you know, connect to their point of view. That's what I find with the audition process.
But this workshop you did had actors that were not just the ones that ended up on the film. So it was like a more expensive process.
Luckily the Morgan, who plays the younger window cleaner, he was with me, and the actor who plays the dad, Moses, Kurt, who's also like a really good friend of mine, he was with me as well. And I knew that they were both gonna, you know, they were both gonna play the parts. And so like with different workshops, they came in to help me read with the other actors that are coming in and kind of explore, improvise. That's really interesting, actually, what you can discover when people are able to improvise within the context of the scene. I think that's a much more useful kind of auditioning process for a character, because it's not just someone who's learnt the lines or who's reading the script. It's actually someone who's able to create, you know, make a creative offer based on the context of the script, not just make the offer, but to live that imagined reality, you know, within the space. So it's, you know, there's something about working in that way that makes a kind of a more collaborative approach possible, you know. And ultimately, you know, when actors have ownership of the characters, you know, they just do such incredible work. And I often think the contribution of actors can be underrated, because I think like when an actor's has ownership of the character and has confidence in what they can offer, it just becomes like an amazing process of discovery, you know. And I think they can reveal things to me about the character that I wasn't aware of, which is what I tend to try to look for, you know, because something becomes universal. A story becomes universal when there's a kind of when multiple perspectives are able to express it, you know. So in that sense, that tends to be like my process.
I just need to ask, because I'm curious, do you remember any moment where you saw that little glimmer of light appear in an actor's face while doing lines, where you thought, oh, he's taking or she's taking ownership of the role? Because you've said something, like a certain question, a certain nudge, a certain push, and a certain reaction, either during the workshops or on set. Do you remember such a moment?
Definitely. I mean, there's quite a few moments, but One moment that really stayed with me was, you know, after Moses has a fight with the window cleaners and Jojo gets hurt and they go back into the house and Moses, you know, is telling Rosie off, you know, and her response to it, like, you know, the way she cries, you know, for me, that was like such an embodied moment where Melody had fully embodied the emotional point of view of Rosie. And the thing, you know, the focus wasn't on the crying. The focus was on her wanting to fix it, her wanting to fix the thing that's now broken, which is the security of that of the house, you know, and the trust that Moses has, you know, for her. So in that moment, you know, it felt, you know, we did a take in which we had no dialogue, and then we did a take in which it was with dialogue. It was like a difficult choice to make, because the one without dialogue was so poignant as well. But you see, in that moment, the reason why it worked is because she had taken ownership of the backstory, you know, the story that Rosie carries with her, which is her past, and her present, which, you know, which is her relationship with her brother-in-law, essentially.
So there's a distinctive zoom shot in lines when the family visits a new house. It's clearly this modern house representing a lifestyle of really stark contrast with their own. And the zoom happens as they enter the opening gates. And so my question is quite direct. What led you to choose a zoom as opposed to a push-in or even a still shot? Because, you know, the zoom offers a realistic perspective. So it's almost like you're mimicking a CCTV camera in this lush neighborhood or something. And yeah, I was curious.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, that's an interesting question, because it's instinctively, it was the feeling of wanting to create a distance between, wanting to create a kind of physical distance between the camera and Rosie and Grace, who are at the door. And there's something about experiencing the scale of that house, this modernist kind of luxury house. There's something about the scale of it. There's something about the zoom that achieves a kind of, a distance. At the same time, we want to get a close up, but there's something about maintaining that distance that we kind of explored. But it's interesting, just thinking about it almost like a CCTV camera as well, because there's something, cold. There's a coldness to it, which I think was like necessary for the experience. But also, it's that feeling of like Rosie's no longer in the, although the flat that they come from is, you know, deprived and kind of like falling apart. There is a kind of immediacy and a warmth in the way like things function and in the way the camera functions in that space. But there's something about going to this place of affluence in which like then they it, the space treats them in a certain way, which is in a cold, removed, kind of distant kind of way.
Yeah, and the fact that we know how the zoom works mechanically, yeah, kind of also helps to you know, give that perspective of the, yeah, mechanic and the coldness and everything really.
Yeah, and there's something kind of like ominous about the kind of this slow kind of zoom, you know, and there's and I think with that house, there's something about that house that just, you know, this idea of like, you know, a wealthy black family live there who are also immigrants. And it's for me, it's really important to show that there's not a single story, a single, you know, immigrant story, a single narrative. It's like, you know, the hard thing about, you know, about life and about society is like, there's so many multiple complicated narratives, and the temptation is often to kind of find a simple explanation, but actually there's something about, you know, they go into this space, it's cold, it's distant, you know, the Grace is essentially a domestic worker there. You know, when Rosie goes up into those rooms, there's a kind of, you know, this echoey, it's kind of like vast, you know, there's some, so I was thinking a lot about about that relationship to the space itself and finding a different kind of visual language to that of the estate.
There's always a distortion that happens with the zoom, so I think, yeah, it really helps to give that perspective you're talking about. Yeah.
There's one more with the zoom in which when she comes back onto the estate, and then the camera kind of like zooms out, revealing the city. So it's this thing of like wanting to create space, wanting to show the relationship to space. There's something about that social housing estate existing in this city that's surrounded with wealth and kind of like power and like these skyscrapers and the financial districts. And yet the kind of the amazing thing about London is that, one thing exists right next to another. It's a real multiple, even the architecture is very much like, this melting pot of different kind of possibilities. So it's to do with like, showing space. I think that's what I was really interested in. Relationship to space.
Yeah, so I thought the choice for the song at the end, PTA by Tabu Ley Joshejo, in the credits was very interesting. It was unexpected because at first it's there's sort of a clash, a contrast with the joyful tone of the song, with the rest of the film, and especially with the end of the film. But it really worked because I especially thought about how the film begins, as you've talked about the two kids. They're playing and they're having fun, and then that moment is interrupted by the woman telling Rosie to be responsible, stop playing it, be more responsible, which I think rhymes with that final image of Rosie having assumed that responsibility, and you feel that weight, which is then sort of interrupted by the song, which is playful. So my question would be, what attracted you to the song and its significance to the characters in the context of the film, of course.
I mean, like in the first instance, there was something about preparing the film and listening to lots of different music by Congolese artists and these incredibly these classics, and just kind of realizing how rich musically the culture is. But the thing that attracted me to that song was there's a kind of, A, it's the melancholy, and B, it's to do with someone. It's a kind of love song, isn't it? It's a kind of like, it's the immigrants' kind of yearning to be loved, to be accepted, to by a space or a society or a culture that, is rejecting them. So there's something about that just really resonated, still holding on to positive. There's something about that song that's full of yearning, full of longing. And so that's what really spoke to me, this longing to be loved, to be accepted, and to be a part of something. And I think underneath it all, there's something really true of the immigrant experience, in that. Possibility. There's something of a lightness and a possibility in that song as well,
And even the lyrics of him talking about, I've been working all day for you to love me,
Exactly,
stuff like that is very,
exactly,
very
exactly.
powerful.
Because there's no, it's like I think it's really important to show the possibility of hope and the possibility of light. And actually, although people, people like the Moses and Rosie and Grace, they're suffering, they're not bitter. They don't they're, like they're not broke, because bitterness can break people, can make people, stop seeing hope. And I think that's real tragedy. When that happens, that's real tragedy. Do you know what I mean? But the thing that works for me with the film is like, the characters are not in that space. The characters are like still hopeful, and I think it's especially now, I think it's so important for us to experience stories that can be life affirming, experience stories that can kind of show us actually, light is possible and kind of hope is possible, and we can get through things that are difficult and still kind of hope. I think that's so important, and there's something very sweet and melancholic about the song that just kind of resonated with me very deeply.
And also, so as a playwright, you have also been recognized for your power to infuse your plays with very gripping dialogue and lots of tension, which is very much present here in Lions, and specifically in the scene we keep coming back to, which is that confrontation with the window cleaners after their misunderstanding. And the good dialogue is also about what's not said, and the body language, and that scene is very strong for that, the way their bodies communicate their points of view, and you can sort of understand what each one of them, the three of them, are thinking, which is obviously a testament also to your directing and your work with the actors. And I love that detail of how both men are revolted at her, but there's a moment where you can see a sort of maybe a glimmer of compassion, or maybe we ourselves project that onto this older window cleaner. There's that shot that lasts a little longer on him, which makes the moment very compelling. And so I guess tell us what advice would you give for writing dialogue, and what elements do you look for to shape something that is naturalistic but very dramatic, or that can be very dramatic?
It's, you know, like early on, I would read, you know, the plays of David Mamet, for example. And there's something about, like, the way David Mamet writes that's so, you know, very close to how people speak. And, you know, there's something about, you know, Harold Pinter, for example, you know, something about the dialogue of Harold Pinter that kind of, you know, reflects the way people speak. And often, you know, these writers, it really inspired me, because I suddenly realized the imperfection of dialogue. It's like, you know, how we often can't really articulate ourselves, and so we're always looking for ways to articulate ourselves better, but it's in the gaps between, it's between those gaps in which who we are is often revealed, or how we feel is often revealed. So in writing dialogue, it's really about, as much as possible, like, listening to the way people speak as much as possible. And in listening to the way people speak, thinking about what are people doing with the dialogue, because the only time dialogue becomes useful or effective in a dramatic sense, it's only when the dialogue is active. You know, if the dialogue isn't active, then it becomes, you know, expositional, and it kind of takes the air out of the scene. But even when someone's being completely inarticulate, but they are using some kind of word, you know, repeatedly, as long as a writer, the action of that moment is, like, clear and identified, it makes it feel realistic. You know, it makes it feel, yeah, that's the one thing I would say to anyone writing dialogue: make the dialogue active and not descriptive. And even if it's descriptive, what's behind the description? What's the character doing with that description, you know?
Yeah. How is it working in terms of the characterization?
Exactly.
So to speak, at the very least. Yeah. Could you mention what are some of the David Mamet plays that you like, now that you brought that to our attention?
Well, I mean, the classic one for me is Glenn Ross. That's the one play that I go back to a lot, which is just kind of extraordinary. And, you know, something about the, for example, you know, when I'm writing plays now, there's something about the overlapping dialogue, for example. Do you know what I mean? There's some, you know, the just the imperfection, repetition, and rhythm. There's something about the rhythm of dialogue that is that's really interesting. I mean, there is I think there's a lot of plays, you know. I mean, even someone like Susan Laurie Parks, who's like this amazing African American playwright, you know, there's a play called Top Dog Underdog, which is just massively influential for me, which has this kind of rhythm of dialogue that's very active, and suddenly, you know, the dialogue itself reveals the characters, because they're really doing things with those words, as opposed to using the words to describe things, you know. But yeah, I find dialogue is, you know, I just find it to be such a key tool, such you know, in making a scene work. And and also when you, when you're kind of exploring the dialogue, you might find, you know, there's a certain rhythm that people have when they speak, and there's a certain rhythm that takes place within a scene, and there's something about that being evident in the dialogue itself. And, you know, when it, like, so I think paying attention to, like, I think rhythms of speech is a really interesting way of, like, unlocking that as well.
Yeah, and you keep register of that while reading plays, but for example, do you record people at all, or yourself, for example, speaking? Because I've heard of, not record in the sense of literally recording, but for example, taking notes. We've heard of these situations where writers take notes on a bus, overhearing conversations.
The advantages actually of being an actor is that you can kind of act the scenes you're writing. You know, you can be on, you know, you know, as I'm writing a scene, I often speak the scene out loud. Do you know what I mean? So like in speaking the scene out loud, I'm already inhabiting that scene, and I'm already feeling like what it feels like to say those words. And that really kind of becomes part of the process for me as well. And, you know, the things that are unsaid are often interesting for me when it comes to dialogue. It's the things that are unsaid, but then that for a viewer feels very clear what the thing that's unsaid is. You know, that's when it becomes that's when it becomes very close to reality.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely. I think, you know, dialogue for film or even for theater, it works best when it works in this sort of harmony with the image. You want to be the film has much visual as it possibly can, and so cryptic in a sense, suggestive in a sense, and a dialogue at its best, it's also cryptic. I find that a lot of mainstream storytelling tends to not be cryptic, you know, and try to be descriptive and say everything of what's going on.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
yeah
exactly I mean, you know, someone like, you know, there's a few filmmakers, you know, that I think use dialogue in like the most brilliant ways. One of them being Spike Lee. You know, with Spike Lee, there's something about the way in which he uses dialogue that's so dynamic, and it becomes an extension of the characters. The key thing is the dialogue is super active, you know. And when you think about like Tarantino's films, for example, the dialogue is like a feature in itself. But again, the thing that makes it work is how active those complicated sentences and words are, you know. So yeah, so that's the key thing, you know, and that's one of the challenges when writing a scene, are to make each moment feel active. But personally, I'm becoming less and less interested in dialogue when it comes to like filmmaking. I just find it like it can be an obstacle. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like dialogue is often an obstacle to the way in which we interact, because we never really say what we mean. And when we do, we never quite articulate it. And so we're searching for it. So I try to find now, you know, ways of writing a scene in which it's just more visual than and less reliant on dialogue. And the joy of writing a play is it's all dialogue. So it's like, you know, there's space to really explore that.
Yeah, definitely understand it. Yeah. Also, now we're speaking of plays. You have you're transforming your award-winning play Exile in Northwest into your first debut feature film, which sounds very exciting. And you're doing it with Steve McQueen's company Llama Spark, together with Film 4. Could you talk about a little bit what is it about, and how has been this working relationship with the production company Llama Spark? And have you met Steve McQueen in the process?
You know, like it's very early days. So we're just in the, you know, process of, you know, just really initial conversations. Steve McQueen is one of the most inspirational directors for me. So it's just such a privilege to be able to, you know, work with his company. And I'm really looking forward to just actually, you know, working with him on this. You know, the story, it's really developing this idea of like the immigrant's experience further. It does have a relationship to Lyons. And it's really, you know, largely from like a child's perspective, you know, and it's actually about forced migration. Because often, when you're a child and you have to move to another country, you don't have that much choice in the matter, So I'm really interested in exploring how people respond to a space that they had no choice in being brought to. And then when you grow up in that space and you have to, find your kind of place within it, how does that manifest? How does that work? It's about these twins, identical twins who respond very differently to the experience of migration. I mean, at the moment, I've been working on a second play, and while things, in terms of like just in the process of working, waiting to get started on the feature film, I've just been working on a second play.
Yeah. Is it going to be, you're going to make the adaptation to the cinema, I imagine. And so at the moment, it's more a financial stage, I imagine.
It's more kind of like, just kind of sorting out the contracts and, initial conversations. And, I'm working with some really brilliant producers at Lammas Park. And the thing we're exploring is the visual language and visual references. We're thinking a lot about films, different kind of films, and just really, there's something about this phase that is kind of amazing, because it's a phase of just like dreaming the possibilities of what it could be. And in dreaming that, we're looking at, I'm reading books, sharing references for books, sharing references for films, sharing references for art. And working on this kind of big document of like compiling all the references across the board. And so there's something really exciting about this process of like dreaming about what the projects will be.
It's like a rediscovery of the thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really exciting when the producers can enter that dialogue. I think it's not frequent, for example, I've talked with the post-production supervisor for After Sun, and in discussing with him how was the process of financing the film, he's constantly in these meetings. It was interesting to kind of be reassured that, oh no, Thomas, these financiers, they're really interested in this independent piece of filmmaking. It's not like this hostile idea of the producer or the financier has, is it clear, is it not clear? No, they are invested in the artful representation of the film, so that's reassuring. Is Steve acting as the producer as well in your film?
I think he will be. He will be. I think he will be, like, probably like as an executive producer. But yeah, I'm not. It's amazing to work with one, someone that one has like admired for a long time. When I saw Hunger, that was like a transformative moment for me as a filmmaker. That film was like, without a doubt, like, truly a transformative moment, actually. So yeah.
His films were also very inspiring to me. Shame is perhaps one of my favorite films of his. A very complex, very specific niche theme.
Amazing
in terms
film,
of human experience. An amazing film, precisely how you say, how he explores quietly and visually the troubles of this man who feels invaded in his territory, his house, is very, very raw. So it's very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so expanding, our view into your work, you also have written for television with credits such as Letting Go, a drama for Channel 4, and you're developing a TV series called First Love. So could you describe what it is like to write for television, how the process differs from writing for film? In terms of work relations, what's the relationship like with the commissioning body?
Yeah, so for example, with Letting Go, that's the first TV drama that I've written, and it's going to be broadcast on Channel 4. And there was something about like that experience which was very, very collaborative. When I say that, because the producers at Blacklight TV, was super involved in like the story development, and it's something that I it was kind of extraordinary, actually, like the level of support that I experienced on that project, and the support being having people that you can really excavate the story with, and you know, excavate the possibility of the directions of what where the story can go. And there's something about like just the plotting, the process of just plotting everything, that is so vital when it comes to like TV drama, because you know, that's a project I didn't direct, I just wrote it. And so in writing it, one has to be like aware of like time, and one has to be aware of like, you know, the screen time you have, and the fact that actually one can't, you know, use so much dialogue to express what's happening. So with TV writing, you know, something that really kind of, you know, changed my practice is just the value of plotting and structuring, which was that process for me, actually, and letting go. And there's something about a TV series that has to feel open-ended, meaning that I'm often used to writing a story that has an ending. But there's something about writing, developing a TV series. Now, in fact, this morning I was working on it, and just, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was, what is it about this series that will keep people engaged, or, you know, for a second season, etc.? And it's to do with character, and it's to do with questions, and it's to do with having a central question in the series that can be answered. But then, of course, there's more possibilities to interrogate that question further. And the question can be to do with character, to do with like, a kind of objective or a kind of quest, you know. So it's a very new process for me, TV writing, but it's something that I just love because of the reach you have. And also it's so character based. That's what TV is. It's all about character. And the emphasis is not so visual, although of course that's a big part of it. There's something about TV writing and playwriting, I think, that has a closer relationship for me, because both deal with character relationship in a much more kind of continuous way.
Yeah, I was just going to add that you made me reflect on the idea that this continuity actors often say about plays, that you're doing it in real time as opposed to film, where you need to kind of stop, restart the performance by take. And so the series, in the sense, you also have, not the sense in real time, in the sense they're performing in real time, but in the sense that you create this familiarity with the character over time. So there's this also notion of time that's different from a film. It's not a unit of time of 1 hour and a half. You create this familiarity. It's like franchises in filmmaking have that sort of feel. That's why their audiences are so keen to buy their trust with characters in franchise, because, oh, I know that guy or that woman from these series of films. So if that's interesting. It's unique, a trait to those mediums.
Yeah, you know, a TV series that, you know, has been massively kind of inspiring for me was Rami. Rami on, I think it started on Apple TV. Just an amazing TV series, which is really to do with that. You know, you spend time with this character, and you know, it's just like, yeah, it's the point of view, that perspective, which was so fresh and just so kind of like human. I love that series. And that's the thing, when you're writing TV, you have space to spend time with the character. And in spending time with the character, there's a, you know, relationship you create with the audience. And I think that's one of the real kind of advantages of like long form a narrative in that sense, you know, is the character study.
Yeah, and so finally, when can we hope to see Lions maybe available online or on streaming platforms? I don't know if you have any plans for that. And also, you already talked about this a little bit, but do you have any idea about, I guess, the schedule of Exile in Ortwiesi, when maybe you'll be moving on to the next phase, or when do you hope it'll get released? I know it's still early on, but...
With Lions, we're hoping to, you know, have it on, like, you know, a kind of streaming platform, you know, sometime this year. I'll let you know, guy. I'll let you know actually as soon as it's been confirmed. And with Exile, I'm hoping, you know, I'm hoping within like a couple of years, simply because the writing process,
of course,
does, you know, take, like, I'd say, like, you know, to write a feature, I mean, you know, I've written so many features and it's taken a lot of time, but in this instance, I feel like, you know, within 2 years, I'm hoping to have the film completed and you know, in front of an audience. Interestingly, just thinking about the writing process now, you know, I'm thinking a lot about just the kind of plot points with the feature. So I'm not kind of like diving into like actually writing the script. I'm thinking a lot about like just the sequence and the feature and the plot points, and because when you really identify the beats, and you really identify the point of view of the film, the actual, you know, script writing process becomes like much more organic, you know. So I'm just in that phase with it, and you know, you get a lot done, and in seemingly kind of, you know, easeful and more relaxed way of working. It's more contemplative. It's more to do with, you know, thinking through it.
Yeah,
definitely. I'll keep you guys posted.
And that was the latest from Beru Tessema, folks. We would like to thank his presence here today. He is truly an excellent filmmaker. And remember to check out Lions once out on streaming platforms. If you're a filmmaker running the festival marathon, feel free to send us a message for an interview as well. We would love to promote your work. Don't forget to subscribe, share this interview, or simply give us a like. That's how our podcast can grow ever more groovy. And if you're on YouTube and want to see more interviews like this, check out this next video right here. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.